Okay, so let's get started here.
Can I just ask a quick question about the homework real quick?
Oh, sure.
In one of the parts they have go through the FCFS, FSD, and C-scan and scan for the disk retrieval. For C-scan and scan, I remember you saying in class that a lot of the times they have optimization to where they don't have to go to the end of the disk.
That's called look. Yeah. That variant is called look and C-look.
Okay, so in the homework you just wanted to do C-scan and scan, not
C-look. Not look and C-look, no.
Okay.
Okay, so so we have only a couple of slides that have overflown from last time, and then we are going to do a course wrap-up here. Okay, it's going to be a short class. Excuse me, my voice is still hoarse. Okay, so we were talking about distributed file systems last time, and we looked at this notion of clients and servers and how clients can access files that are stored on remote machines. We looked at what are some naming conventions and how files can be accessed. So to make this more concrete, let's look at Sun's network file system, or NFS. So NFS is pretty much a standard in the Unix and the Linux world. Okay, in Windows you have CIFS or Samba as a way to share files. Mac has its own protocol, AFP, Apple File Protocol. But in Unix, or any flavor of Unix or Linux, this is basically the file system of choice for sharing files. Okay, and it is a file system that was designed by Sun Microsystem. Subsequently, it was standardized, and now there are dozens of implementations of NFS by every vendor and others. So this was designed maybe two decades ago, yeah, the file system, and it was primarily designed to share files across a LAN. Yeah, the basic motivation was, if there are files on a disk on a different workstation, how do I get access to it on my machine? Okay. So in NFS, nodes can be both servers and clients. You can export files from your machine to some other machine, in which case your machine is acting as an NFS server. Similarly, you can mount files from other servers, in which case you are acting as a client. Okay. Traditionally, NFS has employed a stateless protocol. Okay. Now this is no longer true, because NFS has gone through many iterations. Okay, so what you see today are implementations of what is called NFS version 3. Okay. Version 3 is stateless, but there is a new version that has been announced, but not many implementations exist yet, which is NFS v4. Okay, in NFS version 4, the server can maintain state. It is stateful. Okay. But until now, NFS has basically assumed, until version 3, that there should not be any state at the server. So it is possible for the server to go down and come back up, and nothing will be impacted from the client. And the client will just stop talking to the server while the server is down, and when it comes back up, everything is back and running. Okay, that was the design decision they made. Okay. NFS uses the mount protocol to design a global known scale. Last time we talked about absolute names, we talked about mount points, and we talked about a global naming scheme. Okay. Of these three, NFS basically uses mount. In fact, NFS was the file system that introduced the notion of mounts. Okay. And as I mentioned last time, accessing files from a different machine has two steps. Okay. Step one, this system, the server, has to export a volume, which basically means it gives permissions for other clients to access it. Okay. And that is done using the /etc/exports file. I showed you an example of this on the EdLab machines, okay, in the last class. Okay. So the server basically says, here are the files I'm willing to let other clients access. You can even specify which clients can access these files and in what mode. Okay. And at the client end, at the NFS client, you have this file system table, or FS tab, which tells the operating system which volumes to import and what local names to establish for them. Okay, so the mount protocol essentially maps every remote volume that's mounted to a local name. connected to a point in the local namespace. Okay, so it looked at this notion of slash courses. So directories like this on the idle app, these are mount points. Okay? So these are local directories and they actually mount a volume from a remote machine, and these the entire subtree then actually appears to be local to this machine. Okay, this is what NFS does. In fact, and as you may have guessed, NFS is the protocol used in the idle app, okay, in order to share files from the idle app servers to the idle app clients. So question for us is, how does NFS go about implementing its protocol? Okay, and so we talked about this notion of a remote procedure call two or three classes back. So basically NFS is based on RPCs or remote procedure calls, and more so RPCs were first designed for NFS. Okay, it was essentially when NFS first came out, the RPC subsystem was just a component of NFS. Okay, subsequently Sun Microsystems realized that RPCs are a general framework that can be used for many other applications. So they basically package this as a subsystem that any application can use subsequently. Okay? But something to keep in mind, that the first commercial implementation of RPCs was for NFS, and only for NFS, and then they subsequently made it available more widely. Okay? So what does NFS do over RPC? So you can do directory searches. A client can ask the server if a certain file exists in a certain directory that it is mounting. You can use it to manipulate links or directory. You can access file attributes, and you can open files, read files, write files, delete files, and what have you. Okay, so I'll show you a picture here, draw a picture here. This is your client. This is server. A disk on the server. So let's say that's the file tree that's being mounted here. Here on your local. So this appears. This is your local file system, and it appears as a mount point somewhere. Okay, so these files are basically remote files. So anytime you access this local file, yeah, or rather, anytime you access this remote file locally, what the underlying operating system does is it basically has a NFS client module, okay, within the OS, and this OS here has a NFS server module. So the NFS client module and the server module within the kernel communicate over RPCs. Okay? So any file operation is basically done over RPCs. So if you want to create a new file remotely, you make a create call. Okay, this is happens to be a remote procedure call, so you send a create call to the server. Server executes the create on the local file tree, sends back the result. If you want to read a file, you basically send a read. Okay, the server then reads the part of the file you want and sends back the results. Okay, NFS implements the remote service method. Okay, we talked about this upload download model and remote access model. Yeah, NFS uses remote access, which means when you open a file, the file isn't brought over locally. It is always kept on the server. All operations are sent to the server. Server executes this operation and sends back the results. Okay. So that's basically a picture of how NFS works. Now, NFS by design doesn't require any homogeneity of any sort. Okay. You can run NFS server on any operating system, any platform, can run NFS on Windows for that matter. Okay? And the client could be any other operating system or platform, so long as it has a NFS client implementation. Okay? So you could have a Linux machine accessing Windows files over NFS, or Linux machine accessing Mac files or files on a Solaris machine over NFS. So long as both the client and the server implement the NFS protocol. Yeah, and NFS is a defined standard, so the protocol is specified. You just need your implementation to confirm to this protocol, and the client and the server can talk to one another. Okay? So this is why NFS has been so successful, because it doesn't really matter what platform a machine uses, so long as it supports the protocol, you can access files on it. Okay, so it's cross-platform, and that made it one of the more successful file systems early on. Now, as I mentioned last time, one problem with mount points is that you might have different mappings defined in your file system table. Okay? There is no unique global namespace. The same file, depending on where it is mounted on each machine, may have different names. Okay? So I talked about this courses. So So if you mount this volume at this point, okay, all the files for your 3SC 377 class will be available using this local name. Okay, but you could change the mapping in FSTAT and mount it as something like user courses 3CS300. So the same file now has a different name to get to it. Okay, so there is no way for you to impose or guarantee that files, remote files are mounted at the same point and will have the same name. Okay, this can change depending on the environment. Okay, this is a disadvantage. Or an advantage or a flexibility depending on how you see it. Okay. Now here is a picture of NFS implementation. Okay. Within the file system, within the operating system. Okay. This is not really visible. Let me draw it here. Okay, so that picture actually shows what's basically happening in these bubbles I drew here, which are client and the server. This is your operating system kernel. The API that the operating system uses is a system call API. Okay. So there is all of Unix-like operating system support something called the VFS layer. And then you have so most operating systems today will not support not one but multiple file system. Okay, they can access, meaning read or write data from different file system. And the way this is implemented in the kernel is through what is called a virtual file system layer. Okay, this is a layer that basically sits on top of actual implementation and provides a common API to all access all file systems. Okay, so there's only one read call that you expose to applications. Okay. And applications can use the read or write or open or delete calls regardless of the actual file system or the files they are trying to access. You can use the same system call to access files on a FAT32 volume as you would do on an NFS file system, in which case the files are remote. And the way this works is basically through this layer called a virtual file system layer. Okay? As the name suggests, this is a logical wrapper. Okay, on physical and actual implementations of file system. So what happens when you issue a read call is that call or read or write or any file system call is that call actually comes to the virtual file system layer. So what this layer does is it does two things. It checks which type of file depending on the path name are you trying to access, and it will forward that call to the actual implementation. Okay, if you are trying to access a file on a FAT32 volume, this read call gets forwarded to the FAT32 implementation in the kernel. If you are trying to access a remote file over NFS, then the same read call gets forwarded to an NFS layer. Okay. So in other words, this is basically a mechanism that takes in file IO requests and forwards them to the right implementation of file system. Okay. So every file system has to export an API that the virtual file system layer knows about. Okay. And it defines what the API is, and it basically makes the right forwarding calls. Okay. So NFS, as far as OS is concerned, just looks like any other local file system. These are all local file systems that access files on a local disk. NFS is basically a remote file system that goes over a network to access files on a remote disk. Okay. The mechanism works exactly the same. Okay. So if you want to read a remote file, you just use read. It looks from an application standpoint, nothing has changed even though you are accessing a remote file. You do a read, it comes to the files, virtual file system layer. This layer basically checks what file are you accessing. If it happens to be within a mount point, it hands it to the NFS implementation. So this is an NFS client here. Okay. So then the NFS client takes this read call and then it has to do something because it has to implement this read call. Now in case of NFS, since we said you use RPCs, it is going to translate this read into a read RPC. Okay? And this RPC request is going to go over the network, go to a server. Okay? There's an NFS server here, which will receive this read call and service it. Okay? That's the picture that is actually shown here. Okay, so this shows a UFS, which is a local file system, and it shows NFS, and this is the virtual file system layer, and that's the system call. So anything that is a remote file goes down this path through the kernel. Anything that's a local file in this case goes down this path. okay, and then you make RPC request to other nodes. Okay, this is notion clear of how kernels implement A, multiple file systems, okay, and B, how they implement a remote file system in particular, okay, through the notion of RPCs. Any questions here? Okay. So there is another layer here which basically I didn't really talk about, but let's, so this is the buffer cache that is within the operating system. Okay. The operating system, for performance reasons, maintains a cache of recently accessed files. And it doesn't matter whether the files have been fetched over a network or the files have been fetched from a disk. Okay, so before you make any read or write calls, you basically look inside the cache saying, is the data I want already in the cache? Okay. If so, you get what's called a cache hit, and you go back to the cache and just get the data and return it. You don't have to make an RPC call if it was an NFS file that's cached here. Okay, and same is true of local files. Okay. Now, I mentioned that whenever you have caching, you have this problem of cache consistency. Okay. So, you have opened a file, you fetch portions of the file and they are cached here. Okay. Now, if some other client accesses the same file on the server and more importantly writes to this file and updates it, then any data that you have cached here becomes out of date. Okay, we talked about this last time. And then the question was, how do you ensure that read or write requests don't touch old data that may be cached here? So NFS has its own caching policy. Okay, so basically what it does is that it basically asks every NFS client, okay, to flush back any modified data every 30 seconds. Okay, so basically this is a periodic write back policy. Okay, we talked about write through and write back. Okay, NFS employs a periodic write back policy. Every 30 seconds, every client looks inside its buffer cache and says what files have been modified, and all of that data is shipped back to the server. Okay, so what kind of consistency guarantees would you expect to see in NFS, okay, as a result of this policy? Okay, what can happen to clients that are accessing files on one machine when other clients or other applications are modifying the same files on other machines? Will this give you good consistency, not so good consistency, terrible consistency? Yes.
Well, let's say if like someone remotely changes some options to something, and someone like 1 second later changes it to, you know, something else, potentially the other person could think like the option was set to what he wanted to do, but then he doesn't know about someone else changing it.
Right. So what you're basically saying is that consistency is not guaranteed in NFS. Okay, so unlike techniques we discussed last time, NFS employs a weak consistency policy. Okay, every 30 seconds data is flushed to the server. If some other class, so if you modify some data on your local machine, okay, those modifications are not going to be sent back to the server for up to 30 seconds. Okay. So if some other client is accessing data in the meantime, the same file, it will see stale versions of the file. Okay. So you have to write applications with this in mind. This is not true in local file system. Okay. In a local file system, if you modify data, okay, so let's suppose you opened a local file and there are two processes accessing the same file. If process one writes to the file, okay, and that file, that write is processed by the operating system, these changes become immediately visible to other clients. Okay. So local file systems provide strong consistency guarantees, and NFS basically changes this behavior. Okay. So if you have an application that is designed, a multi-process application that is designed to work on local files, you put one of these processes on a different machine and use NFS to access this set of files, your application may start malfunctioning. Okay, because the file system does not guarantee you strong consistency. In particular, a write by process 1 may not be visible to another process, okay, for up to 30 seconds. So these other processes may make decisions based on outdated data in files. Okay, this is something to keep in mind. Okay, this can often happen. So simple example of why this is true is, let's suppose you have an NFS server that stores your code. Let's suppose you're doing lab project, okay? And you have two PCs, right, lab machines that are both using the same file. So if you actually use an editor, okay, to update the file, and this NFS mounted file, these contents may not be sent off to the disk on the server for up to 30 seconds. If you use a compilation program like make on another PC, that PC may actually give you incorrect results because it's seeing old files, it's not seeing the newest file. So you might compile an older version of the file, because although you save data from your editor, okay, you hit save, okay, and you modify this code, it's not been sent back to the server. If you run the compile program on the same PC, then you are okay, because then this PC knows that the file has been modified, but the server doesn't know yet. So if this, if you run a compilation on this other machine, it may actually end up compiling old code. Okay? So you have to be aware of simple things like this. Okay. So that's basically something to keep in mind. Okay, so these are important implications on how applications are written, as I mentioned. So if you have new clients, so once you flush the data, you are okay, because any new clients that come into the system will see the newest version of the file. If existing clients already have this file open, okay, and they have this cached block, then they see out of date information, as we just mentioned. But if they go back to the server for any blocks that are not cached, okay, then those blocks that will be retrieved from the server will be the most up to date version that the server knows about. Okay? So these are some subtleties to keep in mind as far as the NFS implementation is concerned. Now, the reason you have all these problems is the NFS standard actually does not specify what caching policy to implement. Okay? It only specifies the interface that the server and the client use to talk to one another. Okay? It does not specify what caching policy to use. Okay? So this notion of flushing data every 30 seconds is an implementation decision. It's not mentioned by the protocol. So you could write your own NFS client that flushes every 40 seconds or flushes every 5 seconds, and that will be fine. Okay? So many implementations are just decided for performance reasons to use this magic number of 30 seconds. Okay, this is not specified in the protocol. It's something to keep in mind. So you could use your own caching policy that may be stricter or weaker than what existing implementations do. This is a drawback of NFS, the NFS standard, because it basically did not specify what policies to use, and they left it to the implementation. So implementations tend to do different things, but most of them have converged to this policy. Okay, any questions on NFS? Yes, your question.
So if two processes on two different PCs are looking at the same data, and one flushes back every like 5 seconds while one only does every 30. Will the one that does every 30 seconds get to see the information flush back every 5, or does it have to wait till it?
So it all depends on what is cached and what is not cached. So remember that every operating system also has a cache. Okay. So you write here, and this cache is flushing here, let's say every 5 seconds. Okay. If you have actually already cached the file here, okay, so you are not going to check for another 30 seconds whether this cache is valid or not. Okay. So you are basically just going to access data from the local cache. So this is the problem. Okay. Because you have caching, and the file has changed here, and then after some time it goes to the server, but even after it has gone to the server, this PC may still see old content until its cache content expires and it decides to go back to the server. So this is a problem. You have two questions. Okay, your question.
Could they just like, I don't know, just every time you open up a file, just they kind of like go and check to see if the file has been modified instead of doing like a 30-second system?
So when it's not just when you open a file, because you may open a file and it may be open for 5 hours, right? So you have to do this periodically. The strictest way to do it is prior to every read or write call, check whether it has been modified. Okay? This will guarantee strict consistency. It will ensure that every operation is operating on up-to-date content. Okay? But that's also expensive. Okay? If you check every time you do a read or write call, you have to go to a server. Okay? That will slow down your system. Because this is a performance versus correctness trade-off. Okay? So you can actually say, I want a correct system, but it will not give you good performance. Okay? Or you can say, I'm going to relax correctness somewhat. Okay? Things may be out of date by up to half a minute. But you get good performance because you only have to check with the server every 30 seconds. And in that 30 seconds, you may do 500 I/O requests. None of them involve any talking to the server. Okay? So you get good performance. So this is basically the trade-off that NFS has. Or any file systems face, yes, question.
So the operating system generally leaves it up to the application to solve that problem, right?
The consistency problem, is that what you're asking? So the operating system, in this case, the NFS implementation in the operating system has implemented this policy. Okay? If you as an application programmer require that you always need the freshest copy of the file, then you have to implement something on top of this which may include synchronization. Okay, so this is something to keep in mind. So there are problems with implementations because of this issue. Okay? And for the same reason, there is if you actually see mail files, okay, in your inbox, people typically don't NFS mount mail partitions which are inboxes, because there are clients, there is a send mail client that may be writing to the inbox, and there is your mail client which is trying to read from the inbox. And because NFS does not guarantee consistency, there may be old versions of your mail cached on your local client, okay, and being accessed by your mail client, and then the server may have changed. So you may get inconsistent result. Okay, this is precisely why mounting of mail partitions is discouraged, okay, whenever you have NFS. Yes, question there.
Most like mail clients I've seen won't like refresh until you like refresh it yourself. So why do they implement it like that as opposed to changing
everything? Right. So mail clients typically don't use NFS at all. Most of the mail clients you use, they use different protocol called SMTP. Yeah, there's also a remote file, a remote access protocol. So your mail server, okay, this is a disk, this is your mail file, this is your inbox. So what is happening over SMTP is that every so often your mail client is just accessing your mailbox and trying to pull any new mail that may have arrived. Okay, so you can set your mail client to check mail automatically. Okay, or you may say every time I say go refresh mail, then go and do it. This is also a consistency issue. Okay, well, if the new mail has arrived, how much time does it take for your mail client to know that new mail has arrived? Okay, so there may be new mail on the server, but your client may be checking every 10 minutes. So for 10 minutes, you don't know mail has arrived. Okay, same consistency problem that you see in file system, you also get here. Okay? But the thing to keep in mind is this does not use NFS. Okay? And the reason is NFS introduces yet another layer of problems because of caching and inconsistency. Already there is a problem of maintaining consistency here. Okay? So that's something to keep in mind. Your question there is?
Isn't this kind of contradictory that the network transparency and that,
so network transparency is only naming transparency is only something to do with the names of files. It doesn't have anything to do with behavior of files. Here we are not talking about file names. We are talking about behavior of files in the sense when they change, how quickly do these changes become visible to clients. Okay? So it is a different type of issue as opposed to naming. Naming is just something to do with the file name. It has nothing to do with what happens when the file contents change. Here we are talking about what happens when file contents change. Okay? Now it is true that there is a problem here in the sense that things are not the way they should be. Because files are changed but they don't become visible to you. This, as I mentioned earlier, you can guarantee stricter consistency. So file changes become immediately visible, but that comes as a cost. Okay? And most distributed systems don't want to pay that cost because that cost hurts performance. Okay, so as I said, it's performance versus correctness trade-off. Okay, and distributed systems don't use the strictest version of consistency. They try to relax it a little bit to improve performance. So that's the design decision they have made. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. Okay, but they have assumed that that's what works well for users and applications. Okay, are there any other questions on NFS? So that's basically the end of the course. Yeah, so quick review. I will send out a sample final later today. Okay, but what is going to be on the final is cumulative, everything we have done so far. Okay, but emphasis will be given to material we have covered after the midterm. Okay, because there's already been one test that tested you on earlier material. Approximately 75% of the exam will focus on topics since the midterm, which include memory management, I/O systems, file systems, distributed systems. Okay, so those are topics we have done since then, and the remaining 30% will focus on material before the midterm, okay, which basically includes process management, threads, and synchronization. And quick review, so I'm going to just go through this quickly, just to sort of keep you, give you an idea of what kind of material you should keep in mind when you study. As I had mentioned last time, okay, during the midterm, follow the same strategy. Start with the lecture notes. Okay, don't start reading the book end to end. There are like 1,000+ pages in there. Okay, that's a bad strategy. Start with the course notes. Look at what has been covered in each lecture. Try to understand those that lecture material first. Okay, then go back to the book and try to understand what the book is saying about that material. Okay, maybe you have forgotten certain concepts that were covered. Okay, but I am going to test you based on what we have covered in the lecture. Okay, if there's stuff in the book that we have not covered here, you are not going to have to worry about it. Okay, only stuff we covered in class will be on the test. Okay, so it's always a good idea to start with the lecture notes. In particular, pay particular attention to problem type material we have in there. Okay, we have done several in-class exercises where everything from when we did scheduling, for example, we looked at how much time it takes for to service some requests using disk scheduling strategies. When we did paging, we looked at for certain sequences how the cache replacement algorithm works. When we did other forms of memory management, we looked at what are effective access times when you have certain page fault rates. So we have done a whole bunch of these. Okay, pay particular attention to them. Okay, so they are all in the lecture notes. So that's really where you should start from and pay attention. Yes, question there.
So this was kind of about the same thing as that homework question earlier with the scan and the C-scan.
Hmm.
In the lecture notes, it says it can be easily implemented. So like the look ones that it says in the book, but it never talked about look in the slides. So when you say scan or C-scan on the test, do you mean look or?
No. So when we say scan, we mean scan. I think everybody, the textbook and our lecture notes agree on the definition of scan. Okay. Look is just an optimization of scan where you just don't go to the end of the disk. So it will be very clear if there is a question, it will say look. I mean, we didn't cover look, so there won't be a question. But hypothetically, if there's a question, it wouldn't say scan and assume that we are really talking about look. So that term confusion won't occur. Okay, so use the same definition. It's consistent. Both the book and the lecture notes are use the same term.
Well, I don't know. I was going over the lecture notes, and it said that using C-scan, you didn't have to go using scan, you didn't have to go to the end. And that's why I
got it. No, so I think that was just an optimization I pointed out, and I did mention in class that that's really called the look algorithm.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm just saying, why do you want to do wasted work? So, but if you say pure scan, just assume the real scan algorithm. Okay. If you have any confusion whatsoever, state what assumption you are making. Okay. So that way, it's at least it's clear what your solution relates to. Okay. But I don't think there's such confusion should arise. I mean, the questions will be fairly clear on what you are being asked about. Okay, so use that strategy as I mentioned. Start from the book and not the book, so start from the lecture notes and look at what we have covered there, then go back to the book and use it as a supplement. Okay, that's I think a better strategy. Then I'll hand out a final from a previous year that you can use as a guide to understand what to expect. Okay, so quick review of distributed systems. So we talked about the difference between a distributed and a parallel system. Okay, one is we said is loosely coupled because the processors are on machines that are interconnected by network. Parallel system is a tightly coupled system where processors are on the same machine. Okay, multi-core system is an example of a parallel system or a tightly coupled system. Okay, we talked about advantages of distributed systems over centralized or isolated systems. We said you can have resource sharing, several advantages that we talked about. Okay. We also said what are some advantages of centralized systems or distributed systems. These are basically the disadvantage of distributed systems, which basically makes applications more complex. Okay. For application is centralized, it's all in one process, things are relatively simple. But the application is spread across multiple machines, coordinating across machines becomes harder, especially when you have things like synchronization. Okay. Then we looked at the notion of networking and network structures. We talked about what's a local area network, a network that connects machines within a building or a home or small geographic region. And we distinguished this with wide area network. These are networks that connect machines across larger areas, okay? Metropolitan areas, states, countries, continents. Okay? The internet is an example of a wide area network. We looked at a whole bunch of network topologies, okay, ring networks, bus-based networks, token rings, and tree structures, star structures. So you should know what these topologies are. You should know about what are message communication delays in these topologies, worst case number of hops that you might have to encounter for each topology. We looked at all of that, so that is something you need to know. We also talked about which topologies are more resilient to failures than others. A certain topologies, if one node fails, the system basically, the network gets partitioned. Ring was a good example. One node in the ring goes down, the ring gets partitioned. You no longer have a ring. Okay? So which ones are more resilient to failures and which ones aren't. Okay? We looked at the notion of packets and the protocol stack. Okay? So packet is basically a form of communication that allows you to implement message passing. Okay, we said what's a packet, how does a packet get processed by a protocol stack, what are the layers of the protocol stack. We looked at TCP/IP as an example protocol stack. We looked at layers within TCP/IP. Okay, physical layer, the link layer, which is usually Ethernet or something like that, and then you have IP, which is your network layer, TCP or UDP form your transport layer, and above this is the application. Okay. The context of distributed sharing, we looked at three techniques. Data migration, okay, where computations or processes remain fixed on machines, data moves around, okay, goes from one process to another, gets processed. Okay. Computation migration, where data is fixed, computation moves. We said doing a query on a search engine is a simple example of computation migration. Okay. Basically, your query goes over a network. It's a small program that goes over a network, accesses a database on the search engine and returns you search results. Okay. Job migration, which involves data and computation migration. So you need to understand what these techniques are, okay, and what are scenarios where you would use one over the other. Okay. Then we looked at this notion of a remote procedure call. Okay. This is a function call that you make from your application, but really this function call is sent over a network to be executed on a different machine. Okay. So what is the notion of RPCs? How do RPCs differ from local procedure calls? What are various steps you need to follow, okay, in an RPC system? Okay, how does an RPC call actually go from one process to another process on another machine? Okay. We talked about this notion of a stub, which basically takes care of all of this communication. If when you have RPC systems, so you need to know what a stub is and how it works. Okay? So then we talked about distributed file system. Okay, we looked at location transparent names. These are file names that do not reveal the location of the file. Talked about location independent names. These are file names that do not change even if the location of the file changes. Okay, we said most file systems will have location transparency, but most do not have location independence. If a file really moves from one machine to another, it has a different name. Okay. So, and we talked about having a single global namespace. Okay, there are file systems like the Andrew file system that implements it. Okay. And then we spent a bunch of time talking about caching in distributed file system. Okay, so you need to know what is a file cache. Okay, what benefits does it get? You get performance benefits because you're caching portions of remote files locally. Okay. So what are advantages and disadvantages of caching strategies? We talked about write-back caching and write-through caching. Okay. So what are these strategies? What do they give you? Okay. And what kind of caching policies do you need to implement? We also talked about not only how these caches propagate updates back to the servers, but how servers notify clients that have cache data that the data is invalid. Okay, so we talked about a server push and a client pull approach. Okay, so now actually going back all the way to the initial classes. So a quick overview of process management. Okay, need to understand what's the notion of a process, need to know what the notion of a thread, what is a context switch of a process, what happens during a context switch, different between different scheduling algorithms, FCFS, round robin, multi-level feedback queues. What's an I/O bound process versus a CPU bound process? Should CPU scheduling algorithms handle them differently? Okay, and if so, why? Okay, and then there's a whole bunch of material on synchronization. Okay, three synchronization primitives to keep in mind: semaphores, locks, and monitors. Okay, we actually reviewed the whole material on semaphores for a second time, if you remember, because the first time around things were not clear as so we basically looked at this one more time. So now it should be clear what a semaphore is and what it can be used for. Okay, and what's a lock? How do you use a lock? What's a monitor? What's a condition variable? What are types of monitors? We looked at two types of monitor: Hoare style monitors and Mesa style monitors. Okay, and the difference between the two depends on when you give up the lock. Okay, when you basically hand the lock over from one monitor to another, whenever you do a condition signal. Okay, in one case the lock is basically handed over after the process gets context switched. In another case, as soon as you do a signal, okay, the lock is handed over. Okay, to the process that's doing the wait. Okay, so what are the differences between these two? Okay, should understand what is busy wait. Okay, in the context of synchronization. Okay, we talked about deadlocks. Four conditions for deadlocks. Okay, so hold and wait, circular wait, mutual exclusion is the fourth one that I'm forgetting. So there are four conditions. Okay, and these are necessary conditions. They said they are not sufficient. Okay, we looked at counter example as to why these are not sufficient condition, only necessary condition. So you should understand that. So you should know what is the difference between deadlock detection and deadlock prevention. Okay, in a deadlock prevention system, you impose certain restrictions so deadlocks can never occur no matter what. Okay, so you could basically eliminate mutual exclusions. If you say there is no synchronization, there is no deadlock. So these are harsh conditions that you can impose to avoid deadlocks altogether. Most systems don't do this. Okay, they allow you flexibility, okay, but then that can result in deadlock. So they have to employ deadlock detection to figure out when deadlock occurs and break it. Okay, so how do you recover from a deadlock? By killing processes, by forcing processes to give up their resources and so on. Okay. The next big component of the courses were memory management and I/O management. So you need to understand all of the memory management schemes, starting from contiguous allocation, and we did paging, segmentation, and segmented paging. So four different techniques that we studied in class. Okay, what are they? What are the differences? Okay, and then we looked at virtual memory. Was the fifth scheme, and that was basically a way for you to extend virtual memory, and demand paging were a way to extend memory so that there is no limit on the number of processes and to bring data in from disk or swap space into memory when needed. Okay, so all of these concepts deal with that. So what's paging, what's the notion of a page table, what's a translation look aside buffer or a TLB, is basically a cache for the page table. Okay, so that page table lookups are fast. Page tables are stored in memory. Okay, so you don't want to have a memory lookup for another memory access, which will slow down the memory by a factor of 2. Okay, so you use TLBs to speed this up. Okay, we looked at this notion of a page fault. Okay, in the context of virtual memory. Okay, here you are accessing a page that's not resident in RAM, that's on swap space. You have to bring it in when this access occurs. Okay, so what is a page fault, and how is a page fault handled by the operating system? Okay, we looked at several page replacement algorithms, FIFO, min, LRU, and approximations of LRU. Okay, second chance was one approximation that we studied, because we need to understand what is this approximation and how does it really approximate LRU. Okay, then we looked at a whole bunch of things in the notion of context of file systems. Okay, so here we had used disk as an example, and we said how do disks work. You have this notion of seek, rotational latency, and transfer. okay, that you incur, transfer time that you incur in every disk request. Okay. And the goal of most disk placement or file systems techniques is to eliminate the seek and rotational latency as much as possible. Okay, because this basically incurs wasted overhead that you don't want to incur. You would rather have the disk spend its time doing transfer as opposed to seeking to a location from where it has to do these transfers. Okay. So you need to know all of the optimizations we talked about, okay, all the placement algorithms, contiguous placement, use of linked list as a file system structure. We looked at indexed and multi-level index structure, okay, inodes. Okay. We looked at several disk scheduling algorithms, FIFO, shortest seek time first, scan and C-scan. Okay, don't worry about look and see look. We didn't really talk about them. We just said they were optimizations. Okay, so you need to at least know these four, okay, and how they work. What are their advantages and disadvantages? Okay. So basically, like it said in the midterm, you are not expected to write any real code. If there's any problems, like let's say synchronization was a problem on the midterm, only pseudocode is expected so that you understand the logic. So don't worry about writing Java code. I don't know why it says Java code. You will not be required to write C++ code. Okay. You don't have to know very specific details of specific platforms like Linux or Windows NT or Mac. We talked about several examples throughout the course, but we don't really expect that you know specifics. Okay. Mostly, you have to understand concepts. That's something to keep in mind. Okay. Any questions on any of this review material? Okay, so quick wrap up. So as I mentioned, there are four components to this class. We started with process management and threads. We did memory management, I/O and file systems, and distributed systems. Okay, so now you have basically a good overview of how operating systems work, okay, how operating systems are used to communicate with other machines, okay, in the context of distributed system. So important aspect of the course was also to provide some practical experience. Okay, so here we use C++ as our platform. Okay, now most of you or several of you didn't know C++ when you began this course, but by this point in time hopefully you are fairly familiar with how to program in C++. That in itself is a good achievement. Yeah, because the reason we use a different programming language for this course is not to make your life harder. It does make your life harder, but that was not the objective. The objective is to expose you to at least one more important programming language before you graduate. If you only do Java and you graduate with Java and you never looked at another language, that basically doesn't give you a broader set of skills that you should have. Okay. This exercise has hopefully given you some insights as to how languages differ, how you can actually program with another language using concepts that you know from Java. Okay. So with this exercise, at least going through this exercise, will hopefully make it easier to move to other languages down the road. Okay. And believe me, you will. Okay. There are programming languages, new ones come every few years. And you will be expected to know them. So it's good to transition from one to another without much difficulty. Okay, and you have actually done quite a bit of work in this course. Okay, so you basically, now you know how to do threads programming and synchronization, at least the basics of it. Okay, you know how to write a malloc library. Okay, being able to write a library in itself is a big achievement. Okay, most programmers have never had the luxury of writing a library, let alone writing a malloc replacement that works transparently. Okay, so that I think is a good exercise. And now you are writing a simple file system. Okay, too. So that I think you take all of these skills together, that gives you a fairly good set of system skills to work with, okay, for whatever else you end up doing in your career. So I think that's a good achievement. It has been quite a bit of effort, I'm sure, but I believe that the rewards are also good. Okay, now here are several things you can keep in mind. If you want to learn more about operating system, there's a class called 577 that I offer once in a while. Okay, it's on Linux kernel programming. Now I wouldn't recommend that all of you take it. It is basically it requires you to go into Linux and modify the kernel. Okay, modify various pieces of the kernel. So there are assignments on process management that you go and muck around with the CPU scheduler in Linux. There are assignments in memory management where you look at the memory subsystem of Linux modified, assignments to write device drivers and whatnot. Okay, it requires fair amount of effort, okay, to actually go and hack a real operating system. But it is a course that I have offered every once in a while. And if your goal is to really go deep into operating system kernels and get to know the guts of the kernel, this is the class to keep in mind. Okay? There's another graduate level course that I teach on distributed operating system. Okay? This really focuses on the last piece of the class that we looked at, okay? Distributed file systems and RPCs and so on. Okay? So it's an in-depth semester-long study of just the distributed systems aspects of what you learned in this course. It's a graduate-level course, so it's not something that I would recommend ordinarily to undergrads. But every once in a while, I have somebody from 377 who comes and wants to take it. Okay, and they are really interested in going deeper into these techniques, and that's basically the course to take. Okay, there's another note. This is not yet announced, but I will announce soon that I will be offering with another faculty member an experimental course on embedded systems programming, and we are going to use basically iPhone platform as a target platform, okay, to do embedded systems programming. Okay, so if something embedded systems is something that you're interested in, this is something to watch out for. Now again, this is going to be an experimental course, so we are going to limit it to a small number of students in the spring. Try to work out the kinks through the course, because we have not taught this class before, and then we will offer it as a regular course down the road. Okay, so just something to keep in mind. If you are interested in it, come talk to me. Okay, and then before I wrap up, we still have maybe 10 minutes, there are a few pieces of advice I put on this webpage, which we basically call Sermons in Computer Science. Okay, this is basically something that a colleague came up with, and I have put them up. You should certainly look at it. I'm going to spend 2 minutes talking about this. Okay, so these are basically good pieces of advice when you design systems of any sort, any large system. Okay? To keep it simple, to build systems for performance, to use use good programming ideas and techniques when you write large systems, to respect information, and to basically keep a broad set of skills, because what you use to write the systems keeps changing. Okay, so I'm not going to go through all of this, but I want all of you to look at it. It's not going to be on the exam, so don't worry about that. So the first one is on simplicity. Okay, so basically the argument here is to keep systems simple, not needlessly complicate them, okay, because simplicity is basically a good aspect of any system design. If you can achieve all your goals but yet keep your system simple, that's always a win. Okay, you've seen this time and again. That's no question.
Now, when you say simple, do you mean instead of using very elegant looking solutions that may interweave, you do something that's maybe not so?
Well, if you can get away with a simpler idea. Right. It's not, well, the right, it's not elegance. Elegance is also a good thing for us in system design, but it is designing overly complicated system. Putting features in your application that you will never use. Like Microsoft Word is a good example. People don't use 90% of those features, and in fact get confused by it. Okay, a simpler word processor that gives you the 10% of the features that you use most of the time and does it well is a better system for most people. Yeah, because there are more complex systems are also harder to use. Yeah, so end users don't enjoy using them. So that's basically what you mean by simplicity. Yeah, so it's important system design principle that you often forget when you design systems. Okay. Second one is building high performance systems. Okay, so here you want basically your system to also perform well. This is especially true in distributed systems. Okay. It's very easy to make design decisions that have bottlenecks cause bad performance problems in your system. Okay. If you were here a few years ago, you will remember that the Spire went through an upgrade. Our Spire registration system was upgraded to give you more functionality. Okay. But as a result of this upgrade, the system essentially stopped working. It could not handle the registration course, so it kept crashing. So they actually had to impose limits on when students could register. They basically gave out 1 hour time slots and said only these students can register in this time slot because it couldn't even handle the load. Poorly designed system. Okay, so then they had to go and redo, spend a lot of money, bring in external consultants, fix the problem. Okay, they spend more money on fixing the problem than they spent on actually introducing this new feature. Okay, so better to think ahead of time and design your system well than do things later, okay, to fix performance problem, because you will see them one way or another. Okay. The third thing is, basically programming large systems is as much of an art as a science. Okay, so you really have to say that there's this notion of elegance, and elegance is actually a virtue. It's not really something you should shun away from. And as is basically designing large systems. Okay, there are reasons to keep systems modular, so you can actually make small changes to individual pieces without impacting everything. We talked about monolithic kernels versus modular kernels, and there are good reasons people prefer modular kernels. So it's a broad system principle that applies to any system design, not just operating system. Okay, the fourth piece of advice is to actually respect information. Information is valuable to people. It is actually property that you should respect, and something that corporations really care about, and you basically want to ensure that anything you do in your subsequent careers respects people's information as their property and not violate that principle. And the last piece of advice is basically to stay broad, that you shouldn't really go with the local trends and get caught up with it. As I mentioned, one of the reasons we use C++ was to give you more breadth in programming and programming skills. And this is important because you will see every few years there is a new trend. Okay, so today's trend is maybe Ruby on Rails, and then who knows what tomorrow's trend is going to be. So there are new programming languages, new systems, and really you are expected to keep up with this world. Okay, it basically keeps changing every 3 years. And if you want to stay on top of the job market, you have to stay broad and have the latest skills. These are the skills that the marketplace demands. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind as you sort of move along in your careers. Yeah, so go back and read this. These are sort of short one-page pieces of advice. Okay, just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about them here. Okay, so with that, I think we are basically done with the course. Okay, a couple of things here. One was things to end. One was the programming assignment. Okay, and I got a few requests wondering whether we could have more time. Okay, I don't know where people are in terms of finishing this assignment. Are you on track to finish tomorrow?
Done.
Okay, a few people are done. That's great.
Hooray for you.
What about the rest?
Did you say it was okay to submit your code all the way up? I mean, when do we have an official deadline?
Technically, I cannot have the deadline go beyond technically, meaning I cannot have any official deadlines in finals week, but I can give you a few more days. If you hand it in on the deadline, you get your usual small extra bonus, and if you want a couple more days, sure. I think the final day, final is on Tuesday, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tuesday is fine.
Not official, but
the extended deadline.
When will you stop accepting them as late?
Yeah.
I think Tuesday seems to be a good day to hand it in. Don't work on Monday night, all night, working on the programming assignment and blow the final off. That's also a bad strategy, but if you want two more days, I think that's okay. All right, but do try to wrap everything up by Tuesday. Okay, and if you hand things in today or tomorrow, you're going to be okay in terms of getting your bonus. But if you hand it in any time after that, you'll basically you will get your points but not the bonus. Okay, there is a Dropbox. So remember that this one requires a README file to be turned in. Okay, the README file should also specify where the code for your assignment is. You don't have to submit your program listing. Okay? But it should at least have who your project partners are and where is your code, okay, on the EdLab machine. You don't have to put it. If you are a group of three, you don't have to keep the same code in three places. Keep it in one place, but then mention that in your README file. Okay, that's where we'll go to look for it, okay, and grade it. Okay? So hand in your README file. If you want to hand in a hard copy, go to the main office. There is a Dropbox there. Okay, 377 Dropbox, go and drop it off there. you can come and give it to me or the TA. Okay?
So we don't have to do the hard copy?
No, you should do the hard copy, but just the readme file, not the rest. Okay? There's also a homework due today. Same thing is true. If you have it, hand it to me now. If you are, you could hand it to the main office. Okay? Okay, so, alright.